stand by for action.
Gamer's Haven Special Edition.
This is Ethan with the Gamers Haven podcast, and I was fortunate to sit down with another very busy man in the industry, a man by the name of Matt Forbeck. Now, it's another name you might not recognize, but if you go and look at your gaming shelf, you'll probably see his name tucked away in many, many, many books. Matt's been in the industry for quite some time and was kind enough to sit down and talk to me about his career and talk about the game industry and this hobby we love so much. So take a listen, and if you have any comments or feedback, please hit our website, gamershavenpodcast.com. Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items. This is Ethan with the Gamers Haven podcast, and I have the pleasure of being here with Mr. Matt Forbeck. And
hi, Ethan.
Hi, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I was sort of doing some research on this, looking up some, because as is with the case with some of the interviews I've done, some people might not recognize the name of the person I'm interviewing, but then when they go and look at their gaming shelf, they'll find that his name or this person's name sort of pops up a lot. And that certainly is the case with you.
Yeah.
You've been in the business for quite some time. And, I mean, you've done stuff ranging from tons of licensed work with, like, Lord of the Rings all the way to doing stuff with now, I guess, most recently with Margaret Weiss, the Margaret Weiss Productions.
Yeah.
So I want to definitely touch a little bit on that. But Mr. Matt Forbeck is got quite the resume. Like I said, I was looking down that looking down your list of credits and just sort of floored, going, "Gosh, where do I start?" So I'll ask you the question I ask everyone: how did you get into gaming itself? Not writing for gaming, but how did you first pick up the dice?
Yeah, well, my family was always big into games. My father taught me how to play chess very early on, and we always played dice games and card games and everything else. I really got into doing hobby games with Dungeons and Dragons. We had a friend of mine who lived across the street from us who his mother had given him the blue box Dungeons and Dragons set that she had picked up on a blue light special at Kmart that Christmas. And he came over and he told me, his mom came over and talked to my mom and said, "Oh, he's got this really strange game. You should get Matt involved, right?" And we didn't talk about it for like 3 or 4 months. And then summer came and we were bored out of our minds. So we said, "Hey, let's crack that open and see what it's like and give it a shot." And I got hooked pretty darn quickly, and I've been playing it ever since. I think I was 13 at the time, so it's been a while now.
Excellent, excellent. And how did you get into actually working in the industry?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Oh, no problem. How did you get into working in the industry?
That started out, when I was a kid, I was about 16 years old. My father said, "You either need to go out and get a summer job or you need to start a business of some sort." And I think he thought I was going to do like mowing lawns or something. And I decided to start a role-playing game magazine instead, right? Because I had no idea what I was getting myself into. But I had my own booth at Gen Con that summer, and I had subscriptions I had sold, and I did interviews and laid the thing out with paste up and everything. This is in the days before Macintoshes. And I got involved in the industry that way. I also started playtesting games for a company called Pacesetter Games in Delavan, Wisconsin. And they were a bunch of guys who had been ex-TSR designers who had set up their own company. And they did games like Chill and Time Master and Wabbit's Revenge and Wabbit Wampage and a bunch of other fun games. Mm-hmm. And then when I got to college, Troy Denning, who was one of the guys behind Paysetter, said, hey, you're going to Michigan. I know a guy, Will Niebling, who needs help out there doing inventory as a sales rep for the gaming industry. So Will kind of got me into doing that for Greenfield Hobby Distributors and a bunch of other companies. And he would take me out to all the different conventions and have me work the booths. So I started working with Iron Crown and Mayfair and Koplow and a few other companies, Grenadier. And while I was hanging out in the booths with these guys, I would say, hey, you do games. I can do games. You know? I can write that for you. So eventually, because I'd had dinners and beers and whatever with them, they were willing to listen to me, and I convinced them that I could do this stuff. So I started freelancing when I was in college. I freelanced for a few different companies, including New Infinities, which was Gary Gygax's old company, or second company after TSR. Mm-hmm. And after I got out of college, I wanted to go work in Europe. I had a friend I wanted to go see in Spain, but I couldn't afford to get over there by myself. Right? I didn't have a whole lot of money in those days. And so I got myself a student work visa to the closest country that spoke a language that I did, which happened to be the UK, because Spain didn't have one. I actually was fluent in Spanish at the time, but they didn't have a visa program. Mm-hmm. So I showed up in England and knocked on Games Workshop's door and ended up working for them for 6 months on my student work visa.
Oh, nice.
And after that, I came back home and I started freelancing, and I've been doing it ever since.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. So really, you did some work over. That's actually kind of cool. You did some work over in the UK. Have you noticed any major differences in working in the gaming industry over there, across the pond, and over in the States?
Well, in the UK, it's very dominated by Games Workshop, right? Mm-hmm. They have not only one of the largest companies in the entire industry, but they own most of the shops in England, right? There are a number of excellent independent shops in the UK. But they have a different type of shop culture that we don't have here in the States. So most every major city in the UK has got a Games Workshop store in it, and they sell exclusively Games Workshop products. Because of that, they have this wonderful vertical integration that allows them to know roughly how much they're going to be selling and to sell their products as best they possibly can. And they have some very dedicated diehard fans. Over here, our gamers have a lot more choices, mm-hmm, in their face more of the time, right? So while a lot of us do play D&D, we also play a lot of indie games and such. And there's just a broader cross-section of the market that is available to people to buy games from. So that's, I think, the real major difference. I mean, because Games Workshop is such a dominating factor, of course, there's a heavier preference for miniatures games or board games over there that are related to the Games Workshop stuff. Mm-hmm. And I just had a blast playing that stuff. When I was there, I got to work on Space Hulk stuff. So I worked on the Deathwing and the Gene Stealer supplements and some Blood Bowl stuff back in the day. And I made a lot of really good friends there. I had a great time. It was a fantastic place to work.
Excellent. And the Space Hulk just recently got re-released out here, didn't it?
I'm sorry, Nathan, you're breaking up occasionally from the Skype. I hope you can edit out the parts that would screw it up. But
no problem.
Could you repeat that again?
Sure. You mentioned Space Hulk, and you did some stuff for that. Are they planning on re-releasing that at all since they re-released the board game?
The Blood Bowl board game?
Mm-hmm.
Not that I know of, although technically you can call them up and order all the pieces for it right now.
Oh, yeah.
And the rule book is available for free online as a PDF, right? I'm kind of surprised they haven't pushed a little bit more because of the PC game and the Xbox 360 game that came out, and supposedly, mm-hmm, there's a DS game and a PSP game in the works as well.
And this is Blood Bowl.
No.
Right?
This is for Blood Bowl. I'm sorry. I thought you were asking about Blood Bowl because I could barely hear you.
No, it's okay. I did want to talk about Blood Bowl because it is having sort of a major resurgence with the video game and all.
Right, exactly.
What can you, for our listeners, what can you tell us about Blood Bowl itself? Because you've done a lot of work in Blood Bowl.
Yeah, I have. Much more than I thought I was going to at first. I did, when I was fresh out of working for Games Workshop, I did the Blood Bowl Players Companion, which I co-designed and edited and laid out, and then somebody else came in and did that again in England after I was done with it. And then many years later, I was talking to Mark Gascon over at the Black Library, and Marco said, hey, could you pitch us some ideas for some novels? And I said, sure thing. And I gave him a list of like a dozen different ideas, right? And one of them happened to be Blood Bowl. And I kind of tossed it in there as a joke, like, yeah, I love Blood Bowl. There's no way they're going to do novels on it, but I might as well throw it in there. And he said, yeah, we like that one. I'm like, oh, okay. So you, and yeah, we'd like you to write that. Let's make it a trilogy if we can. I'm like, really? Okay. So I ended up writing a trilogy for that. And then the novel sold well enough, they asked me to write a fourth one. And then Boom Studios picked up the license to do all the different Games Workshop comic books. And so they asked me to write a 5-issue miniseries for Blood Bowl for them, too. So I had a Blood Bowl comic book come out a couple years ago. And I really enjoy it. I love the game. I love the universe. It's a lot of fun to work in. You know, it's not often you get to be hyper-violent and hilarious at the same time.
How do you approach writing a novel as opposed to writing like a comic book?
They're entirely different animals. I mean, they have a lot in common in the fact there's a story there and you're there to entertain and you use words to tell it. But a comic book has got a very, very rigid structure to it, right? And there's usually 22 pages exactly, and there's only so many panels you can fit on a page, and there's... You usually want to have your plot twists or your cliffhangers at the end of at the bottom part of the right-hand page, right? So that somebody has to turn the page to find out what happens. So there's quite a bit of stronger structure that's involved, a stronger skeleton that's involved than in a novel where you can tend to wander around a bit more if you like, and or have a little bit more leeway about your pacing. But they're both lots of fun. And the great thing about doing a comic book is that you come up with these wacky ideas and then some brilliant artist comes through and turns them into pictures for you. And to me, that's a little stunning. I mean, I was writing the Blood Bowl books. I'm like, okay. And then the guy's head rolls across the field. And then I see the guy draw the guy's head rolling across the field. I'm like, holy cow, that looks a lot more gruesome than I ever imagined. But it's really kind of neat. It's kind of fun. And then the novels are different because it's really your own thing. I mean, there's nothing between you and the reader at all. It's just you and the text. I think Stephen King one time compared writing to, especially novels, to like ESP, right? Something where you think the thoughts, you put them down, and sometime later at some other point, somebody else is going to have those same thoughts in their head. And so it's kind of intriguing to be able to think about it that way, and that I'm communicating with people with as little between us as we can come.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Now, I know we're jumping around a lot, but you did some work on the Lord of the Rings role-playing game. And was that for, I want to say it was Decipher, but was that Last Unicorn? Or who was that?
You're talking about the Lord of the Rings role-playing game?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry, I cut out there. For some reason, the questions are cutting out, but everything else is coming through.
It's all right.
Yeah, I worked on the Lord of the Rings role-playing game for Decipher. What happened there is they had a very excellent designer in named Steve Long, who is one of the great guys in the industry. And Steve was developing the Lord of the Rings role-playing game, and he's a huge Tolkien fan, right? But at the time he was getting to the point where he's going to start wrapping up the game, the initial development of it, he had the opportunity to become part of a group of people that bought Champions, right? Uh-huh. And Steve's favorite game in the whole world is Champions. So for him, this was like being able to purchase the North Pole and become Santa Claus, right? He wasn't gonna let this pass him by for anything. So as much as he wanted to do work on the Lord of the Rings game, he says, well, this is where my heart is. This is what I'm going to do. And fortunately, I knew the guys at the Decipher role-playing game division, which used to be Wizards of the Coast South and also was Last Unicorn before that. And I had done some work in the Middle-earth role-playing game for Iron Crown Enterprises back in the day. And I was a huge Tolkien fan, too. So they called me up and said, Matt, would you be interested in this? And I said, yes, I very much would love to do that. So I got to do a bunch of books on that. And it was a lot of fun.
Excellent.
Well, up until like Decipher stopped paying.
that could be a problem.
There was a whole rigmarole that went on. It turned out that Warren, who was the guy who ran the company, his brother-in-law was embezzling a lot of money. And I think the conviction came down late last year for him, so. Yeah, nasty situation. I got paid finally, though, so I didn't complain too much.
Well, it sounds
I can
like,
be brutal about that.
It sounds like you've done quite a lot of work with licensed products. And what kind of experiences have you had working with licensed material? Because there's always that extra level in there.
Yeah, it's very interesting because there's a couple of different ways you can work with licensed material. The easy way to do it is to work on a licensed product that's already been published or put out in the public sphere in some form, right? You know, like when you're working on The Lord of the Rings, the books have been out there for decades. There's a lot of other stuff out there you can use as reference material. Or I edited the Conan novels, the Age of Conan novels for Ace Books. And again, you have Conan stuff that's been out there for decades. So it's easy to have other people who've even thought about this stuff and made reference material for you to draw upon. But if you're working on something like when I was doing the Eberron novels, Eberron hadn't been published yet. When I started writing the Eberron novels, they handed me a 12-page brief and said, this is what we have so far. And here's a map, and you know, we plan on developing these parts of the world first, so try to stay away from those while we're working, and you can write over in these corners over here, and we'll try to match them up at some point. But that means I'm basically trying not to trip over the designers who are working in-house at the same time. And similarly, I'm working on a Guild Wars novel, or I just finished a Guild Wars novel a while ago. And, you know, it's a game that's still in development. So it's kind of like shooting in the dark at a certain point, hoping that you're hitting the target right. You know, the saving grace here is that the people you get to work with are fantastic people, especially at Guild Wars. Jeff Grubb came on as a co-author for the book, and Jeff's a fantastic novelist and understands what it's like to be on the other side of that, right? So working with guys like that and with Will McDermott, who was the guy who led up that project, was fantastic.
Excellent.
But it's more challenging because of that. So.
Yeah. And as I said at the start of this, you've sort of had your fingers in a lot of different industries. And you recently, I guess technically it recently came out, but you were involved, of course, in the Mutant Chronicles movie.
Right, yeah.
And that sort of goes back to your work with the Mutant Chronicles RPG.
It does. It turns out that the executive producer for the Mutant Chronicles movie over at Paradox Entertainment is Fred Malmberg, who used to be the guy who owned Target Games that published the Mutant Chronicles role-playing game back in the day. And I've known Fred for at least 20 years, something like that. And when he needed somebody to help him out with the books, he had seen that I was doing novels at this point. And he said, well, Matt, you know, he's the guy I actually edited the Age of Conan novels for as well. And he said, hey, we have this Mutant Chronicles stuff coming up. There's nobody who knows this property better than you. Would you be interested in writing the novel? I said, yeah, I'd love to. I'd actually worked on part of the movie treatment way, way, way back in the day that I don't think anything but maybe three words of had survived, right? They were probably like the mutant, you know, whatever. And so it was neat to be able to come back to it after so long and get to revisit that world. And then try to also, the novel is interesting because Fred was a big fan of the original stuff that he had helped develop. And so he encouraged me to actually try to take the original role-playing game and weave it into the fabric of the film. Because in a film, you can't possibly show everything that's happening. It's 2 hours to try to show an entire universe that they've created for this game background. So they kind of let me go wild with adding stuff, which you don't normally get to do with novelizations, right? They usually say, stick to what's in the script and don't add anything at all, which can be difficult, right? But no, they're like, you know, add scenes, add details, add all sorts of stuff. So I got to go pretty wild on it. I had a lot of fun.
Well,
and then they brought me, I got to go out to the movie premiere too. I took my wife out to the red carpet premiere in Hollywood. That was a lot of fun.
Oh, excellent. So you got to meet like Thomas Jane and all those guys?
Yeah, Tom wasn't there. Ron Perlman was there, Devin Aki, and Simon Hunter, the director, and a few of the other guys were there. Some of whom I saw and some were wandering around in other parts of the party, but we had a great time.
Oh, excellent. Now, you mentioned you've done other novelizations, and you're a big novel writer, so what's the difference in going with, like, original novels to your licensed stuff, but to novelizations? There's got to be a huge difference in tackling.
Yeah, I mean, novelizations are kind of the easiest thing to write in a way, because you've got a basis to work off of, right? You've got a script that's already done, so you know, chunks of the dialogue, the plot already done, the characters are already done, the world background is already done. it's almost paint by numbers at that point. But, you know, obviously you want to give it a lot more breadth and depth at the same time. So it's actually worthwhile for people to read it. You don't want to just mimic what's on the screen. And a lot of times you're writing these things long before you get to see the film, right? You may never see the film before it actually goes to press. I was actually fortunate because they actually brought me in to see a rough cut of the movie, and then I got to go back and revise the manuscript again to make it fit the movie better. So yeah, novelizations are pretty easy, right? They're just straight novelizations. And then you have tie-in novels, which are the Blood Bowl books and the D&D books that I've read and the young adult books I wrote for Wizards, which they're tied into a world, but you come up with your own characters and your own plots and your own situations and everything else. And so there's a lot more creativity that you're allowed to bring to bear on that. On the other hand, you still have to watch about tripping over what other people have done.
Sure.
And I just finished writing two original novels, which are coming out from Angry Robot this summer. The first is called Immortals, and that will be out in, I guess, April in the UK and June in the US. And the other one is Vegas Nights with a K. That'll be out in May in the UK and July in the US. And those are my first totally original novels. And that was a lot of fun, but it's a lot more responsibility at the same time, right? You end up having to do all the world background and making sure the characters are realistic and believable and fit in with the background properly. But on the other hand, if you come up with a great idea, nobody can say, well, we don't do that here, right?
Sure.
So you get to do whatever you want to, essentially. That freedom can be intimidating in some ways, but it's also really a tremendous amount of fun. And I hope to get to do a bunch more of those in the future.
Which type of novels do you like writing more, the original stuff or licensed or tie-ins or anything like that?
You know, I like all of them, honestly. At the moment, I'm really excited about the originals. I would say if somebody said you could do a tie-in or an original, I would do an original, right?
Uh-huh.
But one of the secrets about doing any kind of tie-in work or any kind of licensed work is figuring out what's cool about that property, right? What is it that made the original creators so excited about it, and what makes the fans so excited about it, and what is it about it that you can get passionate about? Because if you can't develop the passion, you're just going to come at it cold, and you're going to hate the entire project, right? But if you can figure out what's exciting about it, and you know, develop that love in your own heart, I think that shows in the final project. I did a game many years ago called Monster Rancher, a collectible card game.
Oh yeah,
and it was based on a Japanese anime cartoon show that was basically came out about the same time as people saw it as a Pokemon knockoff, right?
Right.
And honestly, you know, at the time I was a man in my 30s and wasn't watching a whole lot of kids' television. A little bit, but my kids at the time were too young to really enjoy that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
And so I had to go through and watch, I think, 30 hours of television to catch up on all this stuff. Cartoons that I would never have sat down voluntarily to just say, I wonder what's on TV, oh, let me watch this. But by the time I was done with it, I really liked it. I really enjoyed the characters. I really enjoyed what was going on. I understood the story and the plot lines and why it was so much fun. And I think I was able to bring that to the game because I was able to get myself behind the property.
Right.
So if you can figure that kind of stuff out, I think that's the most important part of starting any of these projects, is figuring out why is it exciting, right?
Sure.
And if it's your own thing, you have to come up with the reason why it's exciting for everybody else.
Right, right.
But if it's something that's already out there, then you have to dig it out and discover it.
Well, you mentioned your two novels coming out, Immortals and Vegas Nights. For the benefit of our listeners, could you give us a quick, you know, what? Tell us about Immortals and Vegas Nights for the people who might be interested.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, Immortals is a near future science fiction novel. It's about a guy named Ronan Dooley, who is the oldest man in the world. He's about to turn 200 years old, and he was a Secret Service agent who was killed in the line of duty way, way back in the about 2036, right? So our future, but his past.
Right.
And he was the first man they actually tried this procedure on, where they would take your brain and back it up and then reload it into a clone body, right? So if you are killed, you can actually be restored to a clone of yourself. Now, the trick with that is that, can you still hear me?
Yep, I can still hear you just fine.
Ethan? Okay, yeah. Sorry, I just saw something here on the screen. I had a picture up there before and it left, so I wanted to make sure I was still broadcasting. The trick with Ronan, though, is that, or with this process, the immortalization procedure, is that it's only available to the very wealthy or to people who have got are willing to pay for incredibly high death insurance, essentially, right? So you've got this situation where the society has got these huge haves and these huge have-nots. So at the beginning of the novel, you discover that Ronan has just been killed and his murder has been filmed for him to see when he wakes up, right? So he wakes up, he goes to see his own snuff film, essentially, and then is tasked with going out and figuring out who killed him. And it all spins out of control from there. So it's a lot of fun. The second novel is called Vegas Nights. That's Night with a K. It's set in Las Vegas in the modern day, and it's a couple of college students who decide they've learned a little bit of magic in school. Not a lot, but a little bit when they're out of college. So they're for their spring break, they're going to go to Vegas, and they think they're going to break the bank, right? They're going to, instead of card counts, they're actually going to change the faces of the cards with their magic. And the first day or two, this goes swimmingly well for them, right? Then they discover that they are not the first people to ever thought of this. In fact, Vegas is lousy with people who know how to do magic, and a lot of them are employed by the casinos. And there's serious trouble because of this. And then, of course, it all spins out of control from there. So, I had a great time working on both these books. They're very different in tone, but still a lot of fun, I think, both of them. And they both have this big movie-style, bombastic, high-action adventure theme going on behind them, too. There's a lot of combat and people fighting. In the Immortals, it's a lot going on with flying cars and different fights and CIA-type intrigue. So I think people will be pretty excited about it if they give them a chance.
Right. That does sound pretty cool. You also mentioned, we mentioned it earlier, but I want to talk about it real quick. Is Margaret Weiss Productions sort of snuck out the Leverage RPG based on the TV show?
Yeah.
And as I understand it, you have sort of a story on getting involved in that.
Yeah, a little bit of one. What happened is I just saw on Twitter, actually, that they had started doing a Leverage role-playing game. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, I know the guys over at Margaret Weiss. So I wrote Cam Banks, who's in charge over there of the production. I said, Cam, dude, if you need any help with that, let me know. I love Leverage. And I've known John Rogers, who's the guy who's one of the creators of the show and the showrunner of the show. I've known him for 3 or 4 years. And so I've been watching the show and I've been really enjoying it. And I found a game was coming out from some people who I really like. I said, geez, I'd love to be involved with that. And then the next thing they know, they said, sure, come on board. So we're really at an early stage of it for me as far as my involvement. They've actually got quite a bit done already. And, it's Cam and Fred Hicks and Ryan Macklin and a couple other people, names I can't remember because I haven't really worked with them all that much yet. But they really got quite a good game already in development. So it's going to come in and write a little bit here, polish a little bit there, and chip a few bank shots from the back corner.
Sure, sure. Now, also, I spotted while I was looking around on your site something you did for Pinnacle a while back was the Brave New World, right?
Yeah, yeah.
What can you tell us about that?
Brave New World was a dystopian superhero role-playing game I wrote myself and designed back in 1999. And then when I left Pinnacle, I took it and sold it to AEG, who then hired Pickford for a year. At the end of the year, they decided, well, this isn't doing well enough. We need to cut the line right now. Because they basically had a lot of other things going on. Just wasn't getting enough love there. And I said, okay, fine. Well, I'll move on. You'll move on. That's the opportunity. And then several years later, this guy named Darren Orange from Reactor 88 Studios approached me about doing a film for it. So I've been working with them for the last few years. And last summer, we actually debuted a 8 or 8 minute proof of concept video that shows the first 5 minutes or the first 8 pages of the role playing game were a comic book. We basically took that and filmed that to show that we could make a movie out of this. And that's actually my next project right now. I'm sitting down and revising the screenplay for that, with an eye toward getting funding lined up for a full feature film.
Oh, excellent. And it started over at Pinnacle. Real quick, could you give us, could you tell, I know, I believe it's still available as a PDF. But
yes.
Could you let our listeners know what sort of the basics behind the Brave New World?
Okay, it's set in 1999, but you know that was back when it was published. But it was a superhero world where the there was a big disaster back in 1976 called the Bicentennial Battle that basically destroyed the entire city of Chicago. And then the president declared martial law and said that if anybody out there has superpowers, you have to work for us or you're an outlaw. So some people joined the government. They became part of what's called Delta Prime, and these are the government superheroes. The people who decided they couldn't stomach that, or the villains, as they may have been, were formed a resistance called the Defiance. And so as a player, you actually start out as one of the members of the Defiance. You've discovered recently they have superpowers. You're not excited about going to work for the government. And you're going to try to join the resistance to get the United States out from under martial law that's been for the last 30-some years.
Uh-huh.
This is all before 9/11, and this is all written before the Civil War comic book that came out from Marvel a couple of years ago. But you can see that these are themes that have become pretty important over the last 10 years.
Sure.
And the big theme in Brave New World is, you know, essentially what kind of freedoms are you willing to give up in order to feel safe, right? And that's not an easy question to answer. I don't try to answer it so much as give different points of view. Every book that you were able to buy for Brave New World after the original book gave you a different faction that you could be part of. Like, you could play the primers, the guys with the government. And I have some great friends who were for AG. That was the best part, and they played the hell out of that. And other people want to be part of the Defiance, and other people want to be part of Evil Incorporated, which were the villains, right?
Uh-huh.
And other books that we came up with along the way. So there are a lot of different ways to play it. Every book was a different way to play the game.
Excellent. Yeah. The reason I ask is I'm a big superhero fan, so that's what I started gaming. So.
I revised the Marvel Encyclopedia for DK Publishing last year.
I saw that.
Yeah. And that was an excuse to read a lot more comic books. That was a lot of fun.
Hey, any excuse, right?
Yeah, really. It's all tax stuff at that point, so it's a good thing.
Well, in with looking at wrapping things up here, I have sort of three more questions I want to ask you.
Sure.
The obvious question, since you've been tooling away at various things for quite a while now, is there anything you could talk about right now that you've been working on very recently?
Well, I think we've covered a lot of it. We covered the novels, which are coming out pretty soon. The Margaret White stuff is the Leverage role-playing game. What else can I talk about? That's a good question.
Now, is the Leverage game actually in print now, or is it just a...
No. It's still in the middle of design.
Okay.
Although we're supposedly having books out, I think, in June or July or August, really. It's supposed to be out this summer for the basic role-playing game.
So they're aiming for, like, Gen Con, basically.
Exactly. Maybe Origins. I'm not sure. I'm not privy to all the inside information. I literally just started on this last week, right?
Well, there you go.
And Cam, who's the guy in charge, is just flown out. Is flying out today to Leverage convention they're having in Portland, Oregon this weekend. So,
really? A Leverage convention already? Wow.
Yeah, it's called the Con, right? It sounds fantastic. I wish I could have gone.
Oh, wow. And
I was busy finishing.
I've seen the first season of the show, and I really enjoy the show, so...
Oh, it's a great show. I mean, every episode is a heist or a caper show. It's fantastic, you know.
It really reminds me of The Sting.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's a sort of serialized version of that.
Exactly. It's like the cross between The Sting, the A-Team, and the Rockford Files, you know. There's just a lot of stability going on. So, and honestly, it makes a great role-playing game because you look at it and you're like, okay, even at the beginning of the show, they tell you the hacker, the burglar, uh-huh. the drifter, the mastermind. So you have different roles that everybody specializes in. And it sounds just like your average role-playing game party, you know?
Oh, yeah. I would never have thought of it as being a role-playing game, but it just makes sense thinking about it now as a role-playing game, yeah.
And retrospectively, like, duh, I would have thought about that and asked about it myself. What the hell? I'm glad Cam did it. So I'm going to add, there's the Hobby Games 100... Mm-hmm. The Family Games 100 Best book is coming out,
right.
I think, next week. I have an essay in that. That's for Green Ronin Publishing,
mm-hmm.
and that's coming out next week, and that's got 100 different essays from 100 of the top game designers in the industry writing about their favorite family games, right? And I wrote mine about Pokemon, which I've been a big fan of. I think it's a great game. It's probably one of the most popular games of all time.
Yeah.
At least in the last century, right? You know, the brand awareness of Pokemon is just brought everybody. If you're under 30, you know all about it, right? So,
it's
been a lot of fun.
My girlfriend's rather obsessed with it, so I can understand.
Exactly. Some other things I can't talk about yet. There's a Brave New World screenplay I'm working on.
Of course.
I'm starting up another novel probably for somebody this at the end of the month based on another gaming property, but that's still early on in development.
Sure.
I've got another small RPG thing I just was asked to do. I'm going to be doing an adventure for another game. And I just asked today to do a short story for an anthology for a friend of mine, too. So, and these are all being mysterious. I'm shaving off all the serial numbers. Nobody knows what I'm talking about.
Of course. My next question is, when was the last time you were able to pick up some dice and play a game? And if so, and what was it?
That's a question. When was the last time I sat down and played a physical game? It's been a little while, but not too long. I recently started writing a column for the Escapist magazine online, right?
Oh, yeah. I just talked to Alan Varney. He writes for them, too.
Yeah, exactly. Alan's a great guy. I think he recommended me for the gig, actually. But the what I had done, it's Days of Adventures with the series. And they asked me to come up with some topics for it. So I basically wrote up my eldest son's first D&D campaign that I ran for him, right?
Uh-huh.
And he had never played the game before I started writing the game. So I said, okay, I'll learn this. He'd been bugging me for about a year to start a game with him and his friends. So we're going to learn the game. We're going to play the game. Get through your first adventure. I'm going to write this whole thing, this whole process, and have fun with it. I think we ended up doing 5 columns for that. Right now, actually, I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to write about next. Because we finished the first adventure. Honestly, I don't want this to just become a travelogue where I'm saying, hey, can I tell you a story about my characters now?
Sure.
So we're going to try to come up with a different angle that I can write stuff about. So if anybody says, I think you should write about this, go ahead and write me at matt@forbeck.com. Tell me all about it. But yeah, that's another thing I've been working on. That was the last time I sat down and played any kind of role-playing games for a while. This weekend, actually, on Saturday, I'm going to go to GearCon, which is being held in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin.
Right.
And this is GearCon, too. It's on a little bit after the second anniversary of Gary Gygax's death.
Yeah.
And what happened is after his funeral, his family had everybody over for a visitation at the Legion Hall in Lake Geneva, where there were many game conventions way back in the day, including the first game convention I had ever been to, which was a Winter Fantasy back in the 80s.
Oh, wow.
And I had not been back to the building since then. But honestly, it was like walking right into my past. I was like, I know where everything in this building is. I know where the bathrooms are. I know where the hot dog stand is. Where the tables are, I used to play games at. And everybody had such a great time there that the family decided that they should try to do it every year if they could. So last year, I took somebody who was my oldest son there, and we ended up walking in just in time to sit down and play a game of White Box original Dungeons & Dragons with Frank Menster,
who
was Gary Gygax's right-hand man at TSR for many years and a great designer in his own right. Frank ran us through the first ever Dungeons & Dragons published adventure, which was the Palace of the Vampire Queen, which I had never even heard of. Right? So it was published by some third-party group, and there was only a few hundred in existence, but he had a copy, and he ran Marty through it. I was there to coach Marty through with a bunch of other players, including Steve Sullivan and his wife, and a bunch of other folks. But Frank even gave out a certificate saying that you had been run through this entire process and go in and get this frame to put on your wall if you like. So that was a great experience, and that's what convinced Marty that he wanted to play some more and got him started bugging me to start the campaign with him.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a lot of fun.
Excellent. And you have a good amount of kids, Aaron's told me is right. Do you like playing anything with them?
I do, although, you know, the little guys are not quite ready for role-playing games at this point, although Marty is trying to encourage them. We have Marty, who's 11, and then we have a set of quadruplets who are going to turn 8 in June, right? Only 7 years old right now. And, you know, Nick, Pat, Ken, and Helen are great for playing other sorts of games with. You know, we play like Connect Four and Blockus and Pinno and a lot of good family style games like that. But they're not quite ready for the RPG stuff yet. Hopefully in the next year or two, I think.
Now, real quick, did you just say quadruplets?
Yes, I did.
Wow. Okay.
Exactly. When my wife was pregnant with quadruplets, I missed my first deadline ever in my career, actually. I was working on...
I think they can forgive that.
Yeah, that's what happened. I was working on... It was Unapproachable East for Wizards of the Coast. It's Justin Rollins' book, right? And I called Rich Baker, my editor. I said, "Bitch, I'm going to be late on this." He goes, "Matt, what the hell's the problem? You're never late." I said, "Well, my wife's pregnant with quadruplets." He said, "Oh, you take your time."
It's like, oh, okay then.
Yeah, what are you going to do? I mean,
yeah, that's...
It doesn't come too often.
All right, well, my last question for you is one I'm trying to get into the habit of asking. Part of the Gamer's Haven is we love... we do this because we love the hobby. What do you love about the hobby that we're all involved in here, this hobby we call gaming?
Yeah, you know, there's so much I love about it. I don't know if I could start. Gaming has been a huge part of my life for so long, and it's really become my career and my passion and a great way to meet many, many, many friends that I've made over the years. For me, probably the best part of my year, other than, you know, like Christmas with my kids or vacationing up north with my kids and my wife, of course, is Gen Con, right? Gen Con is my favorite time of the year, bar none, actually. This year will be my 29th Gen Con in a row. I've been going since I was a little kid, and I just love it. I mean, I've also been a guest of honor like the last 6 or 8 years running. And I'd say as long as you guys will let me keep coming back, I'll be a guest of honor every year. This is fantastic. And for me, Gen Con is the mecca of gaming. This is where it all happens. This is where some of the most amazing moments in gaming have happened. It's where the tribe gets together.
Right.
And re-energizes itself for the entire rest of the year. I can't tell you how many game designers I've talked to that it's the drive back home after Gen Con that they come up with so many great ideas, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's your creative juices are at their peak. You're just ready to burst with ideas and enthusiasm out of all the fun you've had last week talking to everybody else.
Yeah, that was missing Gen Con for the first time in 13 years last year was definitely hard for me. That's why I organized a friends only game convention, quote unquote, with a bunch of people at a house. We ended up having about 30 people over the course of 3 days, and that's I mainly did it just because it was driving me nuts that I wasn't at Gen Con. So,
your body was telling you it was the right time, you know?
Yeah, and oddly enough, is that has ballooned now into a real sort of event, and we've got it's called Can't Con, is what I called it because it was for those of us who can't con. So
exactly,
and we've actually had to get a venue for it this year because about 100 people are showing up. So
wow, yeah, you can't do that in your backyard, huh?
No, sadly not. But I know what you mean by Gen Con. There, it's. There are times I've gone there and sort of been, you know, a little lackluster on the gaming front, and it I go there and it just refills my gaming tanks.
It does. It does. I mean, you get together with all these people who have so much passion for the games and the industry and everything else, and you get to see all the new, cool, shiny stuff, and you get to see friends you haven't seen for the rest of the year most of the time.
Sure.
And all the amazing things that are going on, all the new things people are coming up with. And yeah, how can you help but be enthused after that?
I know it's a wonderful experience, and I am going this year, so I hope I run across you while I'm there.
That would be great. Just stop on by and say hi. I usually post my schedule ahead of time to bump into me someplace.
Oh yeah, I'll definitely try to track you down. Well, I want to thank you for taking the time out of your very busy schedule to talk to me. This was
well, thanks for asking. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
No problem. I always enjoy talking to people in the industry who, you know, love what they do. So it's one
thing. How could you not? That's a great industry to be.
It's one thing I've noticed about the gaming industry in general is the people in it aren't in it really, I hate to say it, but they're not in it to make money. They're in it because they love it.
Now, I have a friend of mine who game designer, Christian Moore, right? Who used to run Last Unicorn. And he ended up going off to Vegas. He's been working in Vegas for the last several years.
Right.
And he said, I went from an industry where people don't care about money all that much to a place where there's a lot of really smart people who don't care all that much about money to a place where there's not a lot of not so very smart people who only care about money. Right? So, it's a very big system shock. But yes. You know, it's true. Games, there are a lot easier ways to make playing games, right? But there's a lot of other benefits that you just can't put a price on.
Yeah, definitely. Well, again, thank you very much for talking to us. It was
anytime. A
wonderful time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
In conclusion, I would like to point out that it's time for a revolutionary new look in primetime and variety podcasting, and the combination of Aaron and Shay can bring this to the world. Yes, for over 20 years, Shay here and the dedicated group of people that make up the Red Phone Zone have been developing the art of internet entertainment to heights were never before considered possible. And at the same time, Aaron here has been developing and creating art and opinions of movies, comic books, and all things geek-related. From the same creative minds that brought you Giant Ketchup, The Iffy Shay Show, and Super Nerd Night, these two giants of the industry have fused their creative juices into one great explosion of brilliant internet programming. And what is this fusion of creative juices called? The Red Phone Zone, a show that will be loved and adored by every Alexa home in the country. Small children will love the cute, cuddly characters. Young people love the fresh and innovative comedy. College kids, intellectual eggheads, will love the underlying symbolism of everything. Freaky, long-haired, dirty, cynical nerds will love that we are freaky, long-haired, dirty, cynical nerds, because that is what show business is all about. Yes, and when the show hits, the careers of the men who made it possible to put the show on the air will skyrocket. People like John Hamm, Brad Hunstable, and even Dr. Gayla Fair will become stars in their own right. The names of these men will become household words like stove, sink, toilet, no, like patriotism, apple pie, and mother. Friends, the United States of America, no, the world needs a Red Phone Zone, and you should download this show. Now, we're not pulling punches here. I mean, there's nothing subtle about this pitch. So download this show and put it on your MP3 player, because we'll all be famous. The Red Phone Zone will be famous, and Ustream will be famous, because we'll all have a hit show in our hands, and we'll get all temperamental and hard to work with, but you won't care because we'll all make a lot of money, and Aaron and Shane will be happy, and you'll be happy, and the Red Phone Girl will be happy, and God will look down on us and smile on us, and he will say, let them have a 40 share.
Aaron, why don't you just say Red Phone Zone, 8 p.m. Central at redphonezone.com.
This is the Vorpal Network.
You've been listening to the Gamers Haven Podcast. Subscribe to the show by visiting our website at gamershavenpodcast.com, where you can also discuss all things gaming in our forum, drop us an email, or just peruse our episode archives. You can also call us toll-free and leave a message to be played on the show by dialing 1-877-416-1270. That's toll-free, 877-416-1270. On our website, you'll also find our actual play podcasts chronicling our misadventures through all things role-playing. Enjoy what you hear? Why not support the Gamers Haven by purchasing Gamers Haven merchandise, visiting our affiliates, or just by clicking on our donate button? The Gamers Haven podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial, Share Alike 3.0 United States license, some rights reserved. Some music in this podcast is used with permission of Joe Hero Band at joehero.com. This is a Thousand Monkeys production.
This concludes the broadcast from World Control.